Good evening. There is a story of a man who was talking to his friend on the telephone. And while he was on the phone with his friend, he was at the same time playing a game on the computer. And when he finished the conversation and he hung up the phone, his wife said to him, "How could you do that? How could you do that to him? You should have given him your full attention." And the man said, "I did give him my full attention. We never had a problem exchanging words, exchanging ideas. I never had to say, 'Oh, what did you say?' I never had to say, 'Oh, I don't understand.' I gave him my full attention. I can easily talk to him on the phone and play a game at the same time." And his wife said, "You should have given him your full attention." And he wondered why his wife was scolding him like that. He couldn't understand it. Because to him, it felt like he was giving his friend his full attention. But was he really? Even though the conversation seemed to go without a flaw or any confusion or question, was he really paying full attention to his friend? And can we ever be really certain that we are giving our full attention to somebody or to something? Can we ever really be certain? Feels like we are. But are we sure? Is there any way to measure if we are being fully aware? Can we measure it? I don't think so. I don't think there's a measurement for it. And because we can never know for sure by some kind of measurement, our attitude becomes important in relating to someone or something. We need to have the attitude that acknowledges I may lose it without knowing. There may be gaps in my attention that I'm not aware about. I may not really be giving my full attention, even though I think I am. So because we can't really know, we have to start with an attitude that says, I will continually try to focus on one thing at a time. It's like a little pledge or a little vow. This is the best way to keep awareness, this pledge. And this shows, this demonstrates an attitude of respect for people and for things, and for our own life activities, and it's an expression of our practice. The opposite attitude is the one that our friend had when he was on the telephone while he was playing a game. His attitude, even though maybe he wasn't aware of it, is, I can get away with it. I can do more than one thing at a time and give my attention to both. I can get away with it. This kind of attitude is a justification or a rationalization of a mind that's looking for entertainment and for diversion. It is not a mind of practice, and it is not a mind of respect. Computer games, I don't play so many computer games, but when people talk about them, it's pretty obvious that computer games are colorful, and they're fast, and they're clever. They challenge us. They have very attractive features, which is, of course, their point. To have attractive features so that you want to play them. This is where human nature comes in. As we know from our practice, our mind is always looking for attractive features. This is the trap of a busy and creative and engaged mind. We are always looking for attractive features. And so we become attached to them and we treat them as toys. Very small children become attached to games. And dolls. Adolescents become attached to cars, and music, clothes, the opposite sex, the image they project. Adults become attached to cars, music, clothes, the opposite sex, success, their image, fame, wealth. No matter how old we are, or as we get older, we have a problem. We become very attached to old ideas and old habits that are attractive features or toys. Clothes, ideas of success, our image, all these things are like toys that we like to play with. One of the reasons, one of the main reasons that we have come to this practice is because we're not sure we know ourselves. We have some doubts about ourselves. Not knowing ourselves, we don't know how to be. We don't know how to be in two ways, in both ways. There's the the personal, everyday world of the relative self, our image, our success, ideas about who we are. And the other way, where we have doubts about knowing ourselves, is what we call the absolute self. We have doubts about our place in the universe. If we don't know ourselves, if we don't know our absolute self. So when we don't understand our absolute self or our true self, and we emphasize only the relative self, the self that's concerned about toys and success, fame, image, when we emphasize just our relative self, we can feel trapped. We can become to feel trapped by those attachments. And we can become to feel that we are just going through the motions if we only emphasize the things of the everyday world. There becomes a sense of not having freedom, a sense of not being natural. In other words, if we emphasize just the relative self of the everyday world, we become addicted to old ways and old habits. So our practice is about discovering who we are in the larger sense, discovering our absolute self, so that we can go from habits and attachments and addictions to readiness of mind, This is our practice. So the question is, how do we do that? Well, the answer is simple. The answer, Buddhism, our practice, tells us the answer. Give up toys. Let go of those toys. In other words, if we want to let go of our habits and attachments, we have to give up seeking for something outside of ourself. Give up seeking for something to play with, some kind of toy. And when we do that, when we can start to do that, we have a chance to return to our true self. This is our practice. As we chanted earlier in the Heart Sutra, our practice is to return to emptiness or nothingness, to return to the reality that has no attractive features. Our true nature doesn't require attractive features. And when we can give up seeking for attractive features, we can return to emptiness and find ourselves. So if we cannot feel or appreciate emptiness, we will always be caught by attractive features. And we will want to possess them. And we see this everywhere. And we feel it in ourselves as well. It's because we continue to look outside of ourselves for satisfaction. When we look outside ourselves for satisfaction, this is the basis for not knowing who we are. It's also the basis for not liking ourselves, which can become a serious problem. We do have to live in both worlds. The non-substantial world of emptiness and this temporal world of expediency and transiency. And we should live fully in the everyday realm of expediency, this material world. We should enjoy it. We should express our creative human qualities. But we need to appreciate things from the standpoint of emptiness and return to emptiness continually. So to be free of habits, we must be free of toys. And try not to create toys from the transient and expedient things of the everyday world. It's okay to see and to appreciate these attractive features. We should enjoy their form and their color and their sound. And this includes people, flowers, food, the rain, the moon, and ourself. We should appreciate these things. But at the same time, to understand that they are temporary and expedient. If we have that understanding, there will be no danger of addiction or attachment or compulsion. So this is why we practice. To be free of toys, when we are free of toys, we will understand the larger world of our true self, the world of emptiness that includes everything. The world of emptiness, the unfolding world that has no shape or form or color and no attractive features. It is the world of everything, and this is Buddha's world. When we are in Buddha's world, we forget all about ourselves. We forget ourselves. We don't attach to ideas about ourselves or pictures about ourselves. In Buddha's world, we return and affirm our universal self. Then, when that happens, we will no longer be concerned with seeking for something outside ourselves. Then we will not have a need for toys. This is the basis of spiritual practice. Of course, if everybody feels this way, they will have to close down Stanford Shopping Center. Well, not really. So, Suzuki Roshi had something to say about all this. And I'd like to read you just a little bit. Said, if you understand yourself as a temporal embodiment of the truth, you will have no difficulty whatsoever. You will appreciate your surroundings, and you will appreciate yourself as a wonderful part of Buddha's great activity, even in the midst of difficulties. This is our way of life. He was very emphatic about this. He uses a strong word, for him a strong word, said, whatsoever. He usually didn't use such strong language. He was very emphatic. He was referring to how we understand our life, how we understand our substantiality and our expediency as a manifestation of something bigger than ourself. And to have this appreciation, we need to see both worlds. To see ourself and to see others both ways. The transient, colorful, playful, suffering, creative, loving, unique friends, relatives, and others that surround us. And also to see ourselves and others empty, without form or shape, inclusive and without separation. So our practice is to drop into the world of emptiness, where we can be awake and aware and not seduced by toys. Does anyone have a question? Yes, sir. Attached to emptiness?
Emptiness. I mean, there's a two type of relative world and emptiness is the other part. So you have to be on emptiness side means you get attached to emptiness.
Oh, no, it's not possible to be attached to emptiness. We can become attached to some idea of emptiness. When that happens, we may start to seek it. But of course, that's not possible. But emptiness, there's nothing there to be attached to. No attractive features. So we just let it be. Yes, Richard.
About attention, paying attention. I was going on a trip, driving about 500 miles, 500-600 miles, and I thought, well, I downloaded an audio book to listen to on my way to pass the time. But I found that when I was driving, you know, there's traffic and there's rain and hills and curves, it was dangerous, and it required all my attention just to drive. And the audio book, it was a distraction. I wasn't able to pay attention. So I turned it off, and I listened to music for a while, or just silence, and it was very apparent to me that my attention is limited, and I need all of it just to drive safely. Otherwise, it's game over. I deleted all my games from my phone, and now I have like 20 extra hours in my week. games are too enticing, so anyway, I just want to share my experience of driving and listening or not listening.
Game over. Thank you. Yes, Ken.
I was going to add to Richard's. I had kind of the same experience. When I first started meditating, I quite often, if not all the time, had the radio on the car when I was going someplace. And after meditating for a while, I started noticing the radio as a distraction and started getting the car, and if it were on, I'd turn it off and drive where I need to go. And there was something about the silence and being with myself in my own space and not having this intrusive noise going on that was taking me away. So I do occasionally have the radio on now, but there's a lot. lot less than when I, before I started meditating. It there was a period where I left it all for quite a long period of time to get in there. So I know what you're talking about. Yeah. Game over. Okay.
Thank you. Yes, Dan.
In a past lecture, you said that Suzuki Roshi said, nothing is real unless it disappears. So does this absolute self disappear?
He was talking about the tangible things of everyday life. When we go beyond the tangible, then there's no more distinction between appearing and disappearing. Yes, Columbine, please.
I was wondering it kind of seems to make sense that we would be attached to things that bring us pleasure. But say, like a painful experience or a grudge, what's the reason for being attached to that?
To be attached to a painful experience? I think a painful experience, or I think you said a grudge, yeah. Those things disturb the sense we have of ourself. And we don't like that. If we have created a sense of ourself that feels comfortable or safe, if we have a bad experience, that self is threatened. Feels threatened, and so we can't let go of it until we can come back to a sense of equanimity, that grudge or unpleasant experience will always stay in our mind as if it is some kind of enemy. And we want to find a way to fight it. We can discover that the best way to respond to those things is not to fight, but to accept and go to the next moment. That's one reason we have our practice, to enable us to learn how to do that. To give up the enemy of a bad experience and to move on. Thank you for your question. Yes, please.
In a world of toys, is childhood a time for toys, or is it beneficial to teach the value of emptiness to a child? Are there good ways to do that?
Oh, we should let children have their toys. Yes. Yes, let's not be too hasty trying to teach children such things. Let them enjoy their childhood and slowly come to appreciate their larger self. Thank you. Yes, please.
I have a question about this renunciation and also living in the normal world. How can both things really coexist? Because it's not a true renunciation.
I don't understand.
You were saying not to be attached to material things, but at the same time we are operating in the real world, right? So how can one not be attached to material things and still, you know, have a normal life?
When the things of our everyday life, when it's time for them to change or time for them to go, let them go. While they are with us, we appreciate them. But when it's time to go, just let them go. So this is non-attachment. But non-attachment doesn't mean we shouldn't enjoy or use the things of our life to benefit each other. But time to change? Okay. We say, okay. Thank you. Yes, please.
My work requires me to be quite skillful, seems to me. And it's for people who, it's material. So it's kind of interesting because it reminds me of what we say in the trades, or, you know, I can't say it for my house, so at the end of the day. So it also reminds me, though, of wondering if you can, about the Tibetan sand painters who seem to be completely engrossed in their skill, very almost, I want to use the attached, I suppose, to this painting in sand, and yet I think it's like 4 or 5 days or some phenomenal amount of time, and they just, as a practice, I think it's similar to what you're talking about, living in this material world, they're working with these material things, creating these beautiful, incredibly beautiful things, and then letting it go.
It's not difficult for them to do that because their livelihood is not dependent on it, their safety or their comfort. They can create it and destroy it, and their lifestyle doesn't change. But for us, when we try to create something with our family or with our work, the result of what we do has some effect on our life. So we don't casually destroy something. We have a bigger challenge than they do. And this, of course, is the very question we are all grappling with, how to bring that practice into our everyday life where one thing affects another thing and could alter our life. And so there's stress there. I think when the Tibetan monks destroy their sand creation, there's no stress. They're free from the everyday concerns.
Seems quite arduous to make 4 days, or a huge amount of time put into it. That costs a lot of focus, a lot of energy, arduous.
Well, probably to them it doesn't seem arduous. It's just something that they're doing. And they don't worry about how long it takes. Unless, of course, they're doing it in a museum and the director says, "You boys have to be out of here by 6 o'clock." But usually they know the task is long and they know they're doing it so that people can see what they're doing and people can witness when they destroy it and that people will learn from it. So they're giving a gift. And therefore, they do it mindfully. But I'll bet to them it doesn't seem arduous. It's just something that they do. Thank you. Yes, Umar.
Just like in our practice, listening to Todd, listening to you answer to Todd, I was looking at these flowers that are sitting right next to you, and I was thinking nature does the same thing, that it takes time to create these flowers, and then they're gone. It just, and something else will form in this place, and just this constant rebirth and fading away is happening, and it's and I was looking back at it, I was looking at this calligraphy, I was thinking this calligraphy is here too, and the person took this time to paint this calligraphy, and it's the same way that they left us with a gift, and we, it's here for us to appreciate it, then they were gone. And so somebody else comes along and looks at it and gets inspired and creates that. The spirit keeps on moving forward and just never stops. And I think somewhere along the line, this is the same way as stars would be born. And they appear and they disappear and they appear and they disappear. And just a reminder of what we have right now is beautiful and we should appreciate that. I think that's one of the great things that we have.
Thank you. Yes, please.
So, if I'm understanding this correctly, then, so as long as you're keeping your absolute life and your relative life in balance, then it's okay to seek success or seek toys in your relative life. As long as in your absolute life you can let go of those things in time. But when you're living in this world, in normal life, quote-unquote normal life, you can have these desires and you can seek them and still be in peace about it.
It's not so much keeping in balance as if there were two things. Everything in our everyday life, everything comes from emptiness. So when we see things that way, when we see the nature of things and their source, then there is no danger that our everyday life will be out of balance. It's our everyday life that we want to keep in balance. And we let it be informed by our understanding of where these things come from, or how they, what is their origin. So, like we said in this chant in the sutra, the form and the emptiness are the same. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Not two different things that we balance. They flow. Ken.
I have to say, first the two four noble truths kind of speak to that too, where the first noble truth would say suffering occurs in life, and suffering doesn't mean you're wailing and acute pain all the time, but it could mean maybe not getting the raise when expected to get at work, or frustrated because you're not getting someplace on time, or any number of milder things. And the second noble truth says, because you're attached to that. And to the degree you're attached to those outcomes and those things, one suffers for that. It doesn't mean you can't exist in the material world, but coming from, I think, from Prajnaparamita, the wisdom that things change, then you can understand when they do go away. But they are persisting through one's life. That you want to keep this. I want to keep my old age pension nearly, right? And that may not happen. And when it doesn't happen, how much are you going to suffer for that? I don't know. That's something I think we all have to confront. Believe me, the older you get, the more you get to see how things go away. Well, that's not necessarily true. Right? Every age has its issues. So that's an offering right there, is that yes, it is that attachment that causes one, throws them off the mark, the game over, right, so to speak.
Thank you.